Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's August 22nd, 2021, and welcome to episode 240 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know. Will I ever find my way back to
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and saving screens. I'm Paul Hagstrom in Boston, and I am joined today by two retro computing enthusiasts, Earl Evans in Portland. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good, Paul. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing well. We have a degraded hurricane outside, which it turns out is really just a light sprinkling of rain, but it managed to take out Blake's power, so Blake's not here because of that. So,
but you're too tough for a hurricane. Can't take you out.
That's right. I made a little fist for the YouTube people. and also joining us today is Carrington Vanston in Toronto. How are you?
I'm fantastic. How are you?
I'm still...
Can you compete with that? Wonder if you've upped your game.
I'm fantastic plus one.
Oh, you win.
Okay.
I am defeated.
I can see no end to this game. So, it's been a while since we've recorded an episode here, but we, sometime in the distant past, thought it would be an interesting idea to talk a little bit about screensavers. They had come up, I think they came up on the 4th of July, maybe, because I remember thinking we were going to talk about that because of, you know, fireworks and screensavers and things. And
Right. That's right.
So, anyway, but Earl, you said you had a little screensaver story.
I have a little story about screensavers. Yeah, kind of interesting. First off, I love screensavers. And, you know, we'll mention some of the greatest hits. I'll probably wait till we go around the table on that. But when Windows NT first came out, we were adopting it at one of the places that I worked. And so we set up a server. And the server was sitting there with a CRT and a keyboard. And we didn't want the screen to burn in because we knew burn in was a thing. And it had a built-in screensaver. And the cool part was it had, I don't know if you remember this, but Windows had this cool screensaver with the 3D pipes, that it would draw these pipes and kind of the circuitous path of different colored 3D rendered plumbing. And it was really a neat screensaver. And so we liked it. And so we turned that on. Problem is that actually took some CPU cycles to render. So we discovered that we were actually slowing down our server by having that silly screensaver on. So I had to go in and just set it to the super boring scroll text across the middle of the screen screensaver, which took barely any CPU. And, you know, so our users were happier and we were not as happy after we had to turn that off.
So this was a server that had a screensaver, but presumably not an off switch for the display. You couldn't like turn it off. It's a server.
That is a good point, and I don't know why we didn't think about that.
World's greatest screensaver.
Yeah, off. Power off.
Well, there definitely was a number of computers would just turn their screen off as a way to do screen saving, which seems functional, but at the same time, I guess I can see why that's not super optimal, because then you can't tell if it's actually on. I mean, like the screensaver showing you something indicates that the screen is, you know, that the computer's on. It's not just dead.
But these are computers in the 90s. Like, screensavers are so much a 90s thing. So it's not like computers in the 90s weren't very obviously running or not running if you were near them. Look, it's noisy. It's hot. It's like, so.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know that we would notice this one based on the sound, because it was in a room with a bunch of Sun and HP big iron equipment that made a humongous racket when it was all powered on. So I don't know if you would have heard our tiny little server amidst all that ruckus.
Which is what HP servers called themselves at the time. That was their marketing term. Ruckus.
That's right. PA Ruckus, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I used screensavers, and there were a couple that I sort of like took to that basically have lived with me throughout. I mean, it's kind of interesting that people will keep updating them because they're, you know, some people find this, you know, part of their identity, even in a way, you know, this is what your screen looks like when it's not on. So there was one called Helios that I was a big fan of, and I had it running on probably even classic Macs. And then on the PowerPC, and then, you know, as on Intel. It's interesting. It's like a surface of a bubble, basically, is what it's doing. You know, these bubbles sort of float around, and it's sort of reflective. It's kind of like the effect that you get, like sunshine on gasoline, you know. So I've actually managed to get it all the way. You know, it's now running on my M1 Mini. You know, it's and I've been running it since the mid 90s. But I like it.
It looks like, do you remember like iTunes, before it was iTunes, there was, I think it was SoundJam by Cassidy and Green. And I think Apple basically bought that and turned it into iTunes. And one of the things about SoundJam, if I'm remembering the right app, it was the one that like when it was playing music, it could bring up a visualizer that would display a bunch of stuff. That screensaver absolutely looks like a SoundJam visualizer.
Yeah, that could be.
That's a deep cut for some people, but it really looks like SoundJam to me.
Yeah, I haven't. I never really used that very much. I turned on the visualizer probably four times. You know, each time for 10 seconds, and then thought, this is dumb. I can't use
when
my computer.
Have silence and the same thing.
But so Carrington, you had a story.
Oh sure, yeah. Like screensaver, like you, I use screensavers. I forgot about this, but it turns out, not here at home, but one of my computers at work, a while ago, apparently, I installed a modern version of the After Dark screensaver. You can, on a modern Mac, get the Flying Toasters thing. And apparently I did that because it was like a week or two ago, my screen started showing Flying Toasters. And I was like, oh my goodness, is this a thing that happens? Like if I leave my monitor on and I walk away from the computer? So it seemed a funny thing because I'd forgotten completely about installing it because I turn off the monitor or whatever when I walk away. I mean, who actually needs a screensaver? Mm-hmm. So at some point I apparently put this on the computer, have forgotten all about it. It's just never come up because like, you know, I'm working, baby. So there's no time for that screen to save. But turns out that's a thing that's been running for a while. God knows what kind of cycles it's taking up. So that is interesting. So I do have a funny screensaver story, but before that, have you guys got any screensavers active at the moment? Like, do any of your computers actually have screensavers enabled?
I don't. I'm super boring. The monitors just turn off. Goes into power saver mode. Everything just powers down.
Oh, yeah. Mine, it's basically in Apple default mode. So in fact, Apple default mode is to have a screensaver. So it does, you know, do this, the one I think it's called Drift on the M1. And so that just sort of like turns on after a while. And I do, you know, my computer's on for weeks at a time. So there are occasionally I will do things like go to bed, you know. And so I just leave this on. So I do see the screensaver a fair amount, but.
Cool. Yeah. It's funny, Quinn was mentioning, I think it was last episode or the episode before, whenever it came up, we started talking about screensavers. And she's right that After Dark, and other people as well, but it seems After Dark was the big mover in this space, like they convinced people they needed this thing, which is a very dubious claim. And then they went and convinced people who had this thing that they needed to buy modules and upgrades, which is itself very dubious. And then they got other companies to make and release things that only worked inside this system, which is incredibly dubious. But like everybody loved them and used them, and everybody was just fine with the situation for like a pretty broad definition of everybody that probably included all computer users that weren't crusty nerds. Like I use them. It's essentially Facebook before Facebook. It's one of those things where it's like, I can't believe this existed and that everybody bought into it, but we did. Welcome to the 90s. Like just crazy to me. So anyway, I
liked screensavers. I always thought they were fun. I used the After Dark one. There's people in the chat are talking about some of the things like Johnny Castaway, which was great. I'd like to talk about that one. The After Dark had a game called Lunatic Fringe, which is like a space shooter game that I really liked. And I think doesn't exist for any modern platforms, but there was a I think some people are trying to work on getting it ported to a more modern Mac thing, but it will work up to OS 9. It's really fun. There was that Mowing Maniac, the Pac-Man clone with the guy mowing. I really liked that as well. And a Mahjong game and Solitaire game. It's like I completely bought into the infrastructure. But my story is this. And what this says about me, I don't know. So I was living in Toronto, and this would be, I don't know, I guess mid to early 90s, in a place, if you know Toronto, and the corner, right near the corner of Bathurst and Queen Street. So it's downtown, not the greatest area at the time. And right on the southeast corner, there was a kind of notorious nightclub called the Big Bop. And behind the Big Bop was just a grungy warehouse space infested with everything that might infest a grungy warehouse space. It was 5 or 6 or 7 stories. And I decided I wanted to live in there. And it would be really cool to rent a place in there and just like have a big loft space. But it was a commercial only building. So I had to sign a commercial lease and I thought I was doing something really cool. And everybody in the building was living in the building. There were no commercial places in this building. It was all units. And I guess the landlord just was covering their butt by making us all sign commercial leases. So I had this grungy loft space all painted up in weird purples and oranges and stuff, because of course I did. And it had a what could kind of pass for a bathroom and a kitchen. Like it was not a great place to be living. And there were these wooden slat floors, so you could see down to the people below you and above you, because there was these big gaps. I remember one time a person a couple stories above me knocked over a fish tank, and the water just came down like floor after floor after floor. Oh, no. With little fish. Oh, it was terrible. So living in there at the time, so this is the situation. This is the guy I was at the time, the kind of guy who wants to live in there by choice, right? So I'm living there, and I was dating a lady. She might have said otherwise, but I insisted we went on dates. We totally had gone on dates. So we were dating, or talking, as the kids today would say, and we were about to, she was over at my place and we were about to go out to dinner or something. I think we're going to go see something. We had tickets for something. And we're getting ready. She's putting her coat on and we're standing right beside the desk on which I had a couple of computers. One was an Apple IIgs running a BBS at the time. I had a BBS software called First Class, I think. It was BBS software for that. It was a GUI BBS. So the BBS. And beside that, I had my old Mac SE, which I still had. So these were kind of my two old retro computers I still had hung on to. And the Mac SE, I knew, had a screensaver on it. And the screensaver that was on it was the Fireworks one, even though it's a little black and white screen. Mm-hmm. So you'd shove the mouse in the corner, and like that little pixel would go up, and then it would burst into little fireworks. Just adorable. And I knew that if I just like nudged the Mac of the mouse, I could just like bang it into the corner, because that a hot corner turn on, I could start this fireworks. So thinking I'm super suave, I pull this lady close to me and I kiss her, and then as we break apart, I nudge the mouse over and the fireworks go off, right? So I look over and go, huh? Huh? And she goes, I think we should break up. I don't know if she had already been planning on breaking up with me that day, which is totally possible, or it could be that particular screensaver actually cost me a relationship. Or anyway, I've always laughed at that, so I thought it was pretty funny. So I nudge it over, thinking I'm Mr. Suave, and her first words are, "I think we should break up."
That's pretty excellent.
I was actually pretty devastated at the time, but it's so me, right? It's like, yeah, there's all my relationships in a nutshell. And the thing is, we still went out and did the thing. Like, I don't remember what it was. We were going to some, I don't know, maybe it was an indie play or something like that. So she breaks up with me, and then I take her to a play anyway. And I'm like, oh, just, I really did not have my stuff together at that time. So anyway, there's my screensaver story. One screensaver cost me a relationship. What can you do?
Excellent.
If I had that Mowing Maniac on there, maybe everything would be different and we'd be married then. That wrong screensaver choice was the problem.
So were these games like, what was it, Lunatic Fringe?
Lunatic Fringe. So that was the best.
So that was interactive. Like your computer went into...
Yes, you'd actually... Yeah, when you went into that game, because the screensaver is essentially grabbing the whole screen, it would just go into game mode. So instead of being a screensaver that if you touch anything, it stops the screensaver, So it's essentially not a screensaver anymore. It's simply a game you can play that's built into After Dark. And it was a whole space game. We go shoot 'em up arcade game. And it was really, really good. I loved it. So I played that for ages. And then Mr. Allen in the chat was talking about Johnny Castaway, which was another fantastic one. I don't know if you guys ever... Do you guys know that one?
I had not ever heard of it. I Googled it while you were talking. And you know, it's right. It's new to me. But apparently it's well known.
Yeah. It was great. So it's the guy on the island and like, anyways, it's the
was it Mac
old castaway
only?
Fellow.
Or
I don't think so. I think Johnny Cast Lunatic Fringe was Mac only, I believe. I think Johnny Castaway was an everything thing. I think so.
I see some YouTube screenshots that have colors. Well, yeah, I was going to say that they have PC looking colors, but who knows?
But you would watch Johnny Castaway and stuff that would happen. It's great. I like that one. It would kind of tell a story. I don't know if it's the first one that did that, but it's the first one. It's the earliest I remember that would be like a thing you would watch. That's a, like a narrative thing rather than just, you know, stars or whatever. But it's crazy. There was a whole infrastructure of things in screensavers.
It kind of looks like, you know, I'm looking at some of the screenshots of Johnny Castaway, and it seems like this might not actually be doing the screen saving, if there's always a sky and there's always an ocean.
So yeah, I was going to mention that we were talking about the dubious nature of the screen savers. Like, do you really need them? And I think from what I was reading, the answer is kind of, because the
burn-in was definitely a thing for monitors.
Yeah,
and
the bottom line is
definitely
that a monitor uses phosphor. CRT monitor uses phosphor, and phosphor luminance degrades through usage. And so if some pixels were just constantly illuminated with the, you know, the same thing on for days, weeks, months, then they would lose some of their luminance, which would cause the ghosting effect when that area of the screen is turned off. And I mean, there's monitors that you can actually pick up. The monitor is off and you can still see like the burn-in of the menu or
Macs, you absolutely burn in that monitor at top level. Macs, old televisions the same way. You can go to somebody's house in the 80s and 90s and tell what station they watch the most. Right. It's like burned into the corner as Fox or NBC or whatever. Like the local's like, oh, I see you like that news.
So does that mean that really what you want is black versus on, you know, rather than blue versus yellow versus red?
I think ultimately the best way to save the phosphor is have it not illuminated at all. But if you are going to have something that's moving, that is kind of uniformly, you know, illuminating the screen.
And then everybody can watch the thing going around the screen to see if it ever finally hits that corner.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Like the little DVD icon.
I guess what I was wondering is like if it's moving, if you have like a green thing moving through a red sea or something, that's probably not going to quite work for saving the screen, because it's always illuminated. It's just changing colors.
I think not, because I point out in the chat, end of the line, Joel says, like, arcade games, the CRTs in the 70s were notorious for burning in fixed patterns, like especially maze games. Totally true. Yeah. You'd walk up to like a Pac-Man game and you would see it burned in, especially from the attract mode, running the same thing over and over again, burning into those CRTs.
Yeah. Oh, well. But I mean, I can sort of see... even beyond the actual usefulness of it, I'm sure that that's not why people liked them. I mean, they're sort of an expression of identity, right, and character.
They're just fun.
Yeah. Very good point.
Whimsical. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm in favor of them. I like them. Like, why not?
It is, and it is kind of mesmerizing, you know, to just watch the weird trippy patterns.
So were there screensavers? You know how a lot of games will have a boss key, like those instant spreadsheet. Were there screensavers that did that, where you could just like stick on headphones and if anybody looked over your shoulder, it looks like you're working? I wonder if there are screensavers that were just like fake work.
I think kind of by definition with a screensaver, right, if you hit a key, it goes back to the actual what the computer was doing. So it kind of
this
has
way
a
I could just be like sitting there reading a book or something, and the screen, if anybody's looking at it in the camera, would show me like spreadsheeting away. Do my databases.
That would be awesome. Things typing in the spreadsheet and recalculating.
Yeah.
That's perfect.
I wonder if at game development companies, it would be like when you're working on a screensaver, you'd have a boss key that would bring up a game. No, I'm totally coding the game, man. I put in the spreadsheet. Not here.
Right. Yeah, it brings up or brings up the sort of like hacker style, like mini terminal windows.
I'm hacking the Gibson.
Yeah.
So despite your the event that happened, did you continue to run screensavers?
Totally. Character? To this all day, right. Baby. Love me, love my screensaver.
You're committed. I appreciate yep. that.
What, you think I've changed? Is this the question? Have I changed? Have I learned? Have you met me? Of course I haven't changed.
I do remember. So there was After Dark, which was the big one. But I remember being kind of early on weirdly devoted to one called Dark Side. I think Dark Side of the Mac was maybe what it was called. But Dark Side was the main name of it. And the thing that I remember being different about that was that it was a just an application. Like, it just ran and eventually took over the screen and, you know, did its thing. And you could have little modules for it and stuff. But it wasn't... I think After Dark was some kind of control panel that didn't have an actual... Like, you couldn't quit it easily and that sort of thing. It was a sort of a more embedded thing. And DarkSide was really just another app you could launch. So I don't know why I liked that, but I did like that. I'm not seeing a lot of recognition. So maybe I was alone.
No, I don't know that one. I just had to Google Macintosh repository. Seems to have it. It was made by somebody named Tom Dowdy, but I was completely unaware of it. No, I didn't know DarkSide. It sounds you can kind of tell that was like a 90s thing, because DarkSide of the Mac has the freaking awesome, like, that 90s Mac. You know, we're the underdog. The magazines were always like a little edgy, and like it totally has that feeling to it.
Yeah,
I think I could have named the year of that just from the name.
Yeah, I ran it for a while. I don't know. I cannot pinpoint why I liked it so much, but I had a very strong positive feeling about this and a very negative one about After Dark.
You're a hipster.
I guess that must be what it is. Yeah.
Right. Totally. Too cool for After Dark. We were talking about the televisions burning in logos from TV and stuff like that. And Curtis in the chat is talking about how it's these old older TVs with the Home Shopping Network logo burned into the corner of the screen. That's hilarious.
Yeah. 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 I don't think I have anything further that I wanted to add about screensavers. I'm sure that something will come to me, you know, sometime tonight. But
also other hosts will probably have things to contribute on next show.
Yeah.
So. Yeah.
Because it's such a common thing. Like, we all use them. Everybody's aware of them. If you were a computer user in the 90s, 100% you knew about After Dark, whether you used it or not. Everybody knew screensavers. It was a thing my mom would know. Mm-hmm. So it's just like a common experience when it comes to computing, as common as a word processor or a web browser would be today. And it's weird, because I think if you're a very young person, if I ask my nephew what's a screensaver, he might not actually know. Like, mm-hmm. It's something that was massive, was completely ubiquitous, completely dubiously required, but whatever. But we all bought into it. We all had it. Everybody knew about it. And then it just went away.
Yeah.
So After Dark, you didn't like After Dark, Paul, but did you, I mean, you didn't dislike the flying toasters, though.
I thought right? They were funny. Of course.
Everybody okay. No, because you're not no 210 fan. That's and right. So you knew about the toaster thing.
That's right.
Because I don't think I've ever met anyone who disliked the flying toasters. I mean, you could name almost any computer concept or computer meme or whatever. You're going to find somebody out there who's like, oh, I just hate that. But I've never met a single person who hated the flying toasters. It's just, I don't know what it is about
that's
it.
That's the one
it's
I have on at work.
What's that?
That's the screensaver I have on at work at the moment. That's it. It's nice. The flying toasters thing.
Yeah. I do think that concept quite possibly really launched this thing. You know, like, if they hadn't come up with that sort of cute, weird, but identifiable idea, I don't know that it would have taken off as much. But everybody thought, oh, that's just crazy and funny, and I want that on my computer.
Oh, Daniel in the chat says he was never a fan of the flying toasters.
Ooh.
Oh, flying toaster ties. Nope, sorry, just the specific.
Yeah, okay.
Almost found you one, Earl. Earl, are you wearing a Shonen Knife shirt?
I am. I am indeed.
That's very cool.
You know of them?
Yeah, totally. But I was like, oh, look at you.
Awesome.
I think you had a poster at one point in maybe it was a different room.
Yes, I may have. Actually, I do have a couple signed when they came through Portland.
Ah, very cool.
It was fun to go see them.
Oh, yeah, I know what I was going to say, which is not all that important. But the 3D pipes, I mean, I suppose that kind of came after Dark. But that was the thing that was absolutely everywhere. Like, any paused screen was running those Windows pipes. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, that became completely ubiquitous on Windows, it seems. Like, that seemed to be like a thing I would see all the time, those 3D pipe things. Mm-hmm.
I wonder, though. Well, so that may have been another, like, Windows default. I doubt everybody selected that.
Maybe.
But, okay. Cool. Sorry, I didn't mean to derail the Shonen Knife discussion.
I was just talking about that to give you time to think of your thing.
Okay. We could possibly leave this open for other hosts to talk about. I know nobody listening can see our show notes, but our show notes now has a this will be the fourth in a list of evergreen topics that that can be contributed to. Cool. So computers in school, making games for old computers, getting video out of vintage machines, and now screensavers are...
Have we talked about getting video out of vintage machines? I don't think I talked.
I think it's been a long time. I still have a couple things that I wanted to say about that someday.
Well, we'll someday get there.
Yes.
We could put them together. We could get video out of a screensaver in the classroom. And then, you know, title in. Sorry.
Okay, let's see. So we have some listener feedback. We can turn to that. Tony sent email. Talking about a mini pet 4080 kit build and review. So I think a little earlier, I think this is Time Moth Software. Is that really the name? Do I say that every time? This hardware production company being Time Moth Software, but at any rate, Time Moth. It's sold at thefuturewas8bit.com, and it is a little pet replica. We must have talked about this. But
I think we have.
So the
I mean, they've even made a little chiclet keyboard.
Yeah.
Along with it, and it is very cute.
Yeah, it looks nice. It's so the new thing is this write up of the building, you know, of it. The actual thing is not cheap. It is what, like £300. Is that, or is it 400?
Which, as you point out in the notes, is the
300
cost, not the weight.
That's right. Yes. Because it's a mini pet.
No, only the original pets weighed 300 right. pounds.
And the build review just sort of talks about like how you put it together. And anyway, it's interesting. Earl, are you tempted to get one of these?
Very much so. Yeah, I got to save some of the money in the piggy bank for some other things. But yeah, this one calls to me sometimes.
Yeah.
It's just a cool little kit. And, you know, I think with the pet, it was so much simpler of circuitry that was in there that, you know, it's not really that tough of a hurdle to design something that could be compatible like this. I mean, if you look at it, I think you're looking, you know, the picture that you have up there right now, I mean, that's it. It's just not that complicated of a machine. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think I remember, like, if you lift up the lid, or the hood, or whatever, it's largely space in there.
There's a lot of space. The main board of one of the classic pets is still pretty big, but a lot of that is the area for the RAM, mm-hmm. and some of the main board actually has some of the power circuitry on it.
That's an iconic look, though, the hood up. Of a pet,
yeah,
yes,
like it's like a car hood lifted, like you're gonna go like to work on the computer.
Like your 60s Mustang that you right? pop the hood. It
absolutely iconic look. Like the pet is, I think, an amazing looking piece of industrial design. But even when it's open, like for service, it's like just as cool. Like not a lot of the other computers offer that whole currently in service look, propped up.
Well, and it's got the little, it's the little
just
little,
lovely,
you know, the rod or whatever that holds it up, just like a right. hood. It's pretty yep. hilarious. Anyway, yeah. So if you're interested in it, it's expensive enough that you wouldn't just accidentally get it on a whim.
Whoops! I bought it.
This is on ZX81 Keyboard Adventure. That's where the review is. Who did the review? David Stevenson, August 13th. Cool. So quite recently. So if you wanted to
on the Futures 8-bit site. Mm-hmm. Which we have up on right now. We've been looking at pictures of the case, and but I've moved over to a picture of the Space Invaders playing on the pet. Mm-hmm. And I swear that's the version of Space Invaders that I played when I was a kid, and there was the pet at school, and my friend Samir and I would go into the room, and we would play Space Invaders. And I swear it's this Space Invaders. Mm-hmm. I have a very soft spot for that.
This is actually, this is the only Space Invaders implementation that I know of on the pet, and it plays surprisingly well for really low res character, you know, PETSCII graphics. It actually is a pretty stinking fun game.
Well, as fun as Space Invaders can get.
Right. Yeah, My recollection of how much I enjoyed playing Space Invaders is often larger than what I discover I actually feel now when I try it. Yep. But
there's a nostalgia multiplier.
Yeah,
in
I think so. Asteroids, I think Asteroids fares better.
100% it does. Although Asteroids cries out for a spinning knob rather than the rotating buttons. Oh my gosh, it'd be so much better at Asteroids if it could just give me a dial instead of buttons.
Right.
But yeah, Space Invaders, I went to a cottage once. My friend Mark Sangster and I, when we were really young, had spent with my family up at a cottage for a week or a couple weeks or something. And there was a Space Invaders game by the the tuck shop or whatever. And we played tons of it, listening to Rush and playing Space Invaders. And it's remarkable to me that I could spend an entire week, hour after hour, playing Space Invaders. And that it does not hold up. Like, wow, there were limited choices back then, because it's amazing that that could hold my interest for that long. Mm-hmm.
Oh, it's true. I mean, did either of you play Omega Race?
I love Omega Race. It is one of my favorite games, and it has one of my favorite cabinets. There's a environmental cabinet, like you get inside and sit down and play Omega Race with the controls are on the side of the seat. It is incredible. Ooh. Love that game.
There was a version of it for the VIC-20.
Yeah.
And since it's on a VIC-20, this is a fairly limited version of the game. But I would take it over to my friend's house, and we would stay up practically all night playing Omega Race, just over and over. And now I look back on that and I think it was such a simple game. But I mean, for the time, actually having a computer and having a game you could play on your computer at your house and not drop quarters at the arcade was a unique concept. And we just had tons of fun doing that. Kind of an early LAN party without the LAN.
Right. Anyway, okay, cool. So Jan wrote to mention that, so I'm not sure actually if this was his own keyboard, maybe it was, but was wondering about this keyboard. It was a kind of a Commodore replacement, and he sold it on eBay, but was trying to figure out what it was from. I thought it was just interesting, so I have included it in our roundup of feedback. To describe it, it's basically, well, what's weird about it is that it has a whole row of function keys at the top, so F1 to F10 in sort of like what we would think of as function key locations. The arrows are also up at the top, and it has a number pad. And I don't know, so Earl, maybe you would know, but what Commodore computer has this kind of keyboard layout? Is there one?
From the B128 is one of the ones. It was from the CBM business machines that were not as popular, and some of them actually, if I remember right, wound up getting liquidated through one of those third-party outfits. Mm-hmm. But it's a very interesting keyboard. It has a double zero on the numeric keypad, which is something that you don't see very often. And there's a reasonably new video about this style of computer up on YouTube. And I had just seen that video a couple days before the email came in asking about this keyboard. So it was fresh in my memory. I immediately noticed that double zero key. Huh. And I have never actually seen one of these machines in person, but they look cool and they had lots of functionality. And if I remember right, the Commodore B series even had a SID built in for audio. So it was one of these fascinating, you don't hear much about it kind of computers.
Uh-huh. Okay.
But made for business, not made for really to be like a home/gaming machine.
Okay. Well, so good. So we now have actual information to report back to Jan about what the Commodore keyboard is.
Cool.
Bob wrote over email, basically pointing out something that's on Hackaday that is about emulating the IBM PC on an ESP32. Earl, I think you replied to this email. Did you looked at this a little bit?
I did. I replied to Jan, by the way, also on that keyboard. Yeah, kind of straight away. I let him know because it was just a funny coincidence that I'd just seen the video on that. So I recognized it right away. And I did write back on this too. The ESP32 is just amazing for the amount of power that they pack in into this microcontroller, like a dual core microcontroller with a decent amount of RAM. And I think it runs at 160 megahertz. And you can buy one of the development boards for this for $10 or cheaper.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. So this is actually like a really super cheap, like even cheaper than a Raspberry Pi even.
Yeah, and it has Wi-Fi built in. I mean, the Raspberry Pi Zero W does as well, but the ESP32, like the predecessor ESP8266, if I remember right, both of them, kind of their main deal is that they have Wi-Fi. But the interesting thing is that as a microcontroller, they have so much oomph just all on their own. Like the one I bought, I connected to a VGA port and PS2 keyboard, and there was software that the FabGL library that turned it into an amazingly accurate VT100 emulator with lots of the VT100 features implemented, not just your simple standard stuff. So that's why I wanted it to just have a standalone VT100 clone. But this thing running DOS and running these PC programs is just next level.
And this is like as big as your thumb, right?
Yeah. The board that it runs on to make it be able to do all this is a little bit bigger because it needs a PS2 keyboard and mouse connector. It needs an SD card connector. It needs a VGA connector. Yeah, a few different I/O options to be able to, output video like what you're seeing here. Mm-hmm. But it's still not very big.
So how do you program it? What is it that this chip is?
Well, you can program one of these ESP32 chips with the Arduino IDE.
Okay.
You load in a special board profile, and then you can use the Arduino IDE, write your C or C++ code, and compile it, and then just link it right down to your board. Mm-hmm. There's a little button that you press on the board that says, hey, I'm going to program you now. And then you send down the program and boom, you're done.
Cool. Yeah, I'm hoping to play with some of this stuff sometime. It would be pretty fun to see what you can get these things to do. And I really do like these ideas of like taking these little more powerful computers and putting them inside your old crusty computer to make them do something interesting. So
SparkFun has the ESP32C3 Mini in case ESP32 is too large for you. It is very tiny. It's $8. It's like, my goodness.
It is what I wrote back in the reply was, computing's almost free.
Right.
At this point, when you can get this much packed into such a tiny little board and pay just a few bucks for it, it's like the cost of the hardware computing really isn't the limiting factor anymore. The limiting factor is what you can think of to do with it.
Yeah. Very cool. Oh, and actually, Bob had pointed out in his email that this can run Flight Simulator. So that's the main test, I suppose. Okay, I guess we can leave that, the feedback there, and we can turn to the items of interest in news. And Carrington, you have the first one.
Oh, I do, yeah. Okay, so there's a thing called AppleCorn. So it's not really a thing I can share screen-wise, so we'll just paint you a word picture because it's just a thing on GitHub. So AppleCorn is a cool thing that you can use right now. So you can grab it from GitHub and implement it. And what it does is run a virtual Acorn BBC, a virtual machine on an Apple II. So it lets you run Acorn BBC language ROMs, like games, essentially, on an Apple IIe enhanced, which is pretty amazing. Like suddenly you get to run all your BBC stuff on an Apple II. And I was like, well, how the heck does that work? And the thinking behind it, essentially two things enabled this to be possible. One is the way the BBC talks to memory is different than a lot of other computers at the time did. Most of the times you're poking and peeking directly to chunks of RAM, but on the BBC Micro, instead there's a lot of syscalls. And so it you have this level of abstraction. So rather than poking a directly memory mapped address, you would do a syscall. And so it just can remap all those things. So when you do syscall, whatever, it says, well, no, now we have all that housed here on your Apple IIe. And the other thing it enabled was them realizing, look, the BBC has interrupts and the Apple IIe doesn't. So we're just going to give up on those. So and the problem is, and a lot of things need, like, they're using the interrupt when you press escape to get out of something. And so it just says, hey, whenever we can, we'll just check to see if the escape key's been pressed. But sometimes things will just not ever let us have that, in which case that game will run forever and restart your computer. What do you want me to do? So, but, I mean, that's a totally valid approach, because, like, there is no other solution. There are no interrupts on the Apple IIe, and you're not going to get them. So I thought it was pretty funny. They said, well, you know what, just let's just do the best we can without those and see what happens. And it's pretty cool. So you get to, like, if you have an enhanced Apple IIe, you now can download and run BBC ROMs in this BBC Micro virtual machine. That is really, really neat. So you play games. Go play your BBC games on your Apple IIe.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. It's called Applecorn.
Yeah. It has a nice little logo too.
Yeah. So you need an enhanced Apple IIe. It's got to have the 65C02 processor. That's the, and you need at least 128K of RAM, because it needs to allocate a whole bunch of RAM free to run this BBC machine. It's the BBC one has to think it's got 48K of its own untouched by the Apple. Mm-hmm. So if you have an enhanced Apple IIe with 128K RAM or more, just run this thing. It gives you access to all the disks. It's ProDOS only, but when you run this, it's not just like running things in RAM. It can write to and from floppy disks. It can work off hard drive. It the software thinks it's running on a BBC Micro. And mostly it's for languages, like to run Lisp and Forth and stuff, but there's a bunch of, you can download a bunch of language ROM games and they'll work too.
This is basically the BBC Micro that it's simulating. Or maybe just, I don't know what it's doing. Emulating? I'm not sure if it's actually emulating it or if it's just being it, because it's, you know, also 6502. But the I mean, the thing that I was going to say about this is that the BBC Micro, another thing that is sort of known for is the ability to connect to a coprocessor, right? I mean, like, it was kind of built from the outset to have like a sidecar coprocessor of some kind. So it seems like they really thought ahead when they made that machine in various ways.
Yeah. So anyway, it's just so cool, because I remember getting a lot of books. You get these programming books and it would say, like, you know, type in this if you're on an Apple, type in this if you're on a BBC or whatever. And now you'd be able to just like run BBC Basic and type in the BBC stuff. Mm-hmm. This is run by Bobby Manners. And it's super cool. Like, the idea that somebody would even think you could do this and go, let's just get it so we can run the BBC Basic on an Apple IIe. Why not? Mm-hmm. Interrupts mean nothing to me. I'm just going ahead anyway. I love it. I love it. The chutzpah to get this done is great.
Yeah, no, so if on the Apple II enthusiasts Slack, there's a you can sort of, this has been going, the development of this has been going by, and it's been interesting to watch it, some of the challenges that came up. Yeah, and it's funny that it's possible.
I just think it's amazing. Like, I'm sometimes people do a thing where, like, I would have, if this were proposed, I would have said, well, that can't be done. Like, right away, I would have been shut down by the lack of interrupts. I would have been shut down by the fact that it's a totally freaking different computer. No, of course you can't run BBC Basic on it. Just, no, you can't. I mean, the fact that she can just come in and just says, I'm doing it anyway.
Yeah.
I'm just very impressed. I'm so impressed by this. So,
I think I'm going to take host's prerogative and reorder this so I can talk about mine next, because I think the ordering between these is going to work kind of nicely, because the one I wanted to talk about is the Atari 64.
Yes. Yep. Cause yours just, it's like a total awesome segue from what Carrington was just talking about. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Go for it.
So this is a very strange project, which is basically recompiling the Commodore 64 kernel to run on an Atari 8-bit computer. So
so giving the Atari a total upgrade is what you're
I'm
saying.
Sure. That is exactly what everybody would say. But so...
All right. Antichoast.
What?
Feedback at rcrpodcast.com.
So there's a YouTube video that sort of shows this in action. 8-bit show and tell kind of ran through this and so ran the 10 print program that does the little maze, but it's typed in on an Atari and it's running clearly as if it's on a Commodore. In the little window you can see the blue Commodore. The idea is essentially is that it's just been recompiled a little bit of change had to be done to make it talk to the right screen addresses and stuff. The source code is here. It compiles into an executable file so that you can just run it. So it's possible to put it on, some sort of flash drive and run it from that. I forget what the name of this one is that the 8-bit show and tell is using here, but it's, it's one of the Atari solid state solutions. And so it kind of runs, but a lot of what the video is, the 8-bit show and tell video is doing is kind of going through some of the places where it doesn't quite match up. So where you mm-hmm. you do, like, you poke things that would normally change the background color or things like that. But instead, if on the Atari, since it's the memory's mapped differently, if you poke that, what you end up doing is corrupting the character set. And so he's demonstrating how you can, like, sort of like black, blink out like increasing numbers of the lines and the at sign or then the A and so forth. And in fact, if you poke an entirely different place, that will tell the Atari to change the background, so you can change the background, but it's just you have to kind of like operate in this weird space between Atari and Commodore. So BASIC works, but poking is dangerous.
So I think ultimately, if I had to characterize these two, it seems like the Atari 64 is kind of a proof of concept. Like just sort of a, hey, let's see what we can get away with in terms of a reimplementation of the Commodore kernel on this system. Whereas the Apricorn thing that you talked about a couple of minutes ago seems like a more complete implementation. Like most things will run unless it uses interrupts, in which case maybe it'll kind of glitch out on you. But.
Yeah. And I think, so there's a sense in which the, the architecture of the BBC Micro kind of enabled that. This thing that the Atari 64 is putting together two things that were never meant to go together, right? I mean, so like if you really wanted to make this work, you would have to probably intercept. I don't even know how you would do this. Like intercept all the pokes and reroute them, or something.
Maybe you could, reprogram the poke command. I mean, but then you wouldn't really be running the same version of Commodore BASIC. Right. But if you intercepted the poke command and said, oh, I think what you meant was this, and put it to the other address correctly, maybe that would work.
Probably easier to run a translator on the software itself. Just move it over rather than something sit there constantly waiting to see if you poke.
Yeah, could be.
I like that Jeremy in the comments says, boo, Comtari.
Yes.
Exactly, Jeremy. Well done.
Oh yeah, I just scrubbed a little forward in the video, and now what's being demonstrated is some of the Atari stuff being wedged over top of the Commodore thing. So the Atari player, the sprite, is being overlaid over the Commodore screen. But you get some extra stuff from the Atari. But actually, the other thing that is being tested here is the Atari runs at a faster megahertz. I think it's running at almost 2. This is an Atari 1200XL. And so there's some actual speed tests between an actual Commodore. This is I think it's a Commodore 64, maybe it's a 128, and then Atari 64, which is running at a faster clock rate, but the Atari sucks clock cycles away to deal with the video. So it turns out that they're actually quite close. Though the Atari does win by a little bit. So it's a little bit faster in most of these benchmarks. But, fails if you try to change the background color. So half and half. It's interesting, though. And it reminded me a fair bit of the challenges that I wound up, talking about in my Kansas Fest talk about the trying to do Apple II emulation mode in the Apple III. What the issue is basically in that case too is that it's the same underlying machine and a lot of the same kind of like architecture, but there are certain things like soft switches and stuff that control the graphics and things that are or the the buffers and stuff in memory that are not quite in the same place, and so it's the same kind of challenge. Like you can either do the remapping, and in which case you limit yourself to kind of like a little machine, or you don't do the remapping and then all the stuff that's written specifically for the Apple II doesn't work. It doesn't quite do the right stuff. So that's, it's the same kind of thing that you could do with the Atari 64, perhaps, by just saying, like, anytime you try to write to this address, I'm gonna catch it before you do and change it to the right one and then send it out, potentially. But of course, the thing is that this is not an emulator. This is actually running 6502. So right. I'm not sure where you put that interceptor. You might have to patch the poke command.
I think in the basic language itself, yeah. if that would take care of basic and poke commands. It wouldn't take care of machine language. I think for that, maybe you do the thing that Carrington was talking about, where you just run through and have some sort of a dynamic code evaluator that says, oh, you were trying to store into this address. I'm going to change you to this other thing anyway. Yeah.
Basically a Clippy for the software. Oh, it looks like you're trying to make a poke. Can I help you?
It looks like you're trying to use a sprite that doesn't exist on this platform. Stop that.
Anyway, okay, so I'll leave that, and we can turn to Earl's topic, which also flows somewhat naturally here.
It does. I'm going to talk about the 576 NUC Plus, which isn't a license plate. It is a computer reimplementation. It is compatible with the Atari 8-bit systems like the 800, the XL, the XE. It is a modern reimplementation like, in many ways, the MiniPET that we talked about a few minutes ago. So here is a new computer, brand new circuit, very small footprint, has 576K of RAM, which is where the 576 comes from in the name, uses actual Atari chips, and so therefore, as they state, you can have 100% compatibility with your Atari software. You can have a integrated FujiNet circuit on this, which would give you it's a little extra money, but it'd give you the FujiNet capability built right in, which is disk drive emulation and network connection and that kind of thing. And you can also get this cool little 3D printed case for it. And if we're looking at a picture of it right now on the YouTube, and the computer itself is actually smaller than the base of the monitor mm-hmm. that it's sitting next to. So you can see this is a small little device, cool Atari 8-bit. And if you totally max it out, the cost is just a bit above $300, which again isn't cheap, but I mean, if you go out and try and buy a reasonable condition Atari 8-bit and then all the fixings that go along with that, you're still going to spend a decent amount of money, and unless you happen to get fortunate and know someone that just gives you one.
And I'm not sure how you get 576K of RAM or whatever it is.
Right. Right. So there's some, there are modern upgrades for the old Atari 8-bits that will give you some of that capability, but this has got it all built in. It's just a neat little project. It's sold at the Brewing Academy. And if I was reading their site correctly, it looks like they may be on a little bit of a summer hiatus in terms of building new ones. They were saying if you order now, it might be, I don't want to misquote, but mid-September maybe before the order gets shipped. Yeah. But this is kind of all the rage at the moment. They were talking about it on the Atari Age forums. They're talking about it on the Antic podcast. And I've included some links that we can put in the show notes to, they're kind of community building reference guide for this, for some instructions. And we've also got a link to where you can purchase one and read more about it. And what was the other link that I put in there? I thought I put three links.
I think it was the short project, the atariprojects.org.
Oh, right. So, on Atari Projects.
So purchase and boot, 15 to 30 minutes. Is how much time you will devote to the purchasing and the booting. I think there's probably going to be some time in there for shipping. But
shipping, unboxing, yeah. But I think what that is kind of indicating, though, is that the setup of this isn't very hard. Pretty much plug and play.
Yeah, that looks pretty cool. It is tempting. Mm-hmm. It is tempting. But, and now you can run Commodore BASIC on it. So.
Right.
So, excellent.
But buy it anyway.
Right. Cool. Okay, let's see. Carrington has another thing. So, what is Carrington? What is your thing?
Just a little one, which this got pointed out on Twitter by Ken Gagne, sometimes host here, and totally makes me laugh. There's a new museum open called the Tech Interactive Museum in Silicon Valley, and it's a museum kind of dedicated to technology, the technology of Silicon Valley, the innovation of Silicon Valley, so you can go in it. And so there was a write-up about it on KOHN, which is a Hawaii, I think it's a radio station, maybe a TV station. KHON radio. I guess it looks like a television station in Hawaii. So he did an interview with the people that are running the Tech Interactive Museum, the Museum of Innovation and Amazing Things that have happened in Silicon Valley. And what struck me and Ken is, one, the person running it says that the focus is not on technology. It's a Tech Interactive Museum. And he specifically says, you won't come here to see old Apple IIs on display. Like, calls it out and says, nope. Like, Silicon Valley, we're all about innovation. I'm like, but that was one of the great innovations of Silicon Valley. But okay. They also say it's so much more than just a museum. It's a place where everybody tests their ability. So it's not a museum. It's not for Apple IIs. It's not about technology. And it's not a museum. Thus, the Tech Interactive Museum. I'm not sure what they're offering there. But it's a thing that's open now. So there's a museum of technology in Silicon Valley, which shuns the idea of showing old computers and wants to insist that it's not a museum, but it's now open.
Yeah.
So it's so funny, the difference between like the living computer museum and this. And so it's like, this is like a science center. We have a science center here in Toronto, and it's a really fun space for kids to go and learn about science in general. But it's pretty funny that somebody would open a thing called the Tech Interactive Museum and insist that it's not about technology and it's not a museum. But it is interactive, at least. Yeah. So it's hands-on.
Yeah.
But I thought it was funny that they called out the Apple II in particular and said, you won't come here and see those dusty old Apple IIs. Who cares?
Nice.
Oh, well. So I will not anytime soon be going to the Tech Interactive Museum.
I'd almost be tempted to take an Apple II in there and just stick it on a desk somewhere.
And just leave it around to set up our own things.
Just to kind of,
because it's funny, if it's a museum, which is about old things, it's a museum about the technology of Silicon Valley. Like, why would you not have old computers in there? It's crazy to me. But they specifically call out that they will never do that. You can't make them.
Excellent. And actually, there's one thing that I will, one more thing I'll mention here, which is that the Retro Challenge is coming back.
Oh, yay.
Cool. So the...
time to start another project that I won't finish.
Yeah.
I actually will try and finish it this time.
I think I have started two, maybe three Retro Challenge projects. I think I have never... Well, I've pretty much never reached the end of them, except the first one, I think, turned out... It was trivial. So, I mean, as soon as I did a tiny bit of research, I realized it was just over. anyway, this is a Retro Challenge 2021-10. If you go to retrochallenge.org, there is an announcement for it. And I guess, just in case you're not sort of familiar with this, the idea is essentially that it is a loosely disorganized gathering of retro computing enthusiasts who collectively do stuff with old computers for a month. I guess there are rules, but essentially the idea is you choose a project and you do it, and it can be pretty much any category that has something to do with old computers. So you're scanning things, or you're trying to get a system to work, or you're trying to write a program, or whatever. It's really pretty interesting, and it just provides a framework to do projects in.
It gives an excuse.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So not an excuse anyone else would accept, but
but sometimes you need that to like motivate yourself, right? Like, to get a framework to say, like, why do it now? Like, there's these little things we think, well, I'll get to it eventually. It gives you a say, well, how about eventually is now?
Right. All right. And I guess we can leave it at that and move to a word from our sponsor.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are flying in the Bermuda Triangle, a place where things are known to disappear and are never found. Now, fortunately, we have an iOmega Zip Drive on board, and with it I can make a quick copy of all my important stuff.
The 100 megabyte zip disk let me save, store, and take all my stuff with me.
No need to panic. Okay, boys, let's take her back in. Hello?
Get an iOmega zip drive today, because it's your stuff.
I'd like to tell you about a really different software magazine called Input. It's a weekly course that program by program will help you get the most from your computer. And it's designed specially for many of the leading computers. Input's clear instructions will have you creating your own animation and sound effects to go with it. And teaches you to understand machine code by using it practically and imaginatively. Oi, leave it out. Input. Learn to program for fun and the future.
And we're back. So the host's retro computing gift idea this time is a book, and a book that Earl knows well and has talked to the authors of, or the author and editor of. So maybe Earl can talk a little bit about the book.
The book is Back Into the Storm. It is written by Bill Hurd, edited by Margaret Morabito. And as the extended title says, it's a design engineer's story of Commodore computers in the 1980s. It kind of covers Bill Hurd's experience at Commodore with two different families of computers. One was the Commodore TED / Plus 4 series of computers, and the other, the Commodore 128 family of computers. And in the book, Bill tells a lot of extremely fun tales about his experience at Commodore, the crazy days there, the friendships that were forged, and the incredible stressful time frame, the pressure that they were under, you know, trying to make the CES show and trying to cram, you know, $50 worth of computer into a $20 production package, and just all kinds of things. And if you followed Commodore in particular, if you've followed Bill Hurd any, you've probably heard him tell some of these stories. They're really interesting, really entertaining, and this book puts them into roughly chronological order. And there's some things in here that I'd never heard before in any of the Commodore things that I'd read or heard about. Also, it has a sort of stream of consciousness feel. So as you're reading through the book, it's not as much like you're reading a history book as it is like you're sitting down with a buddy who's telling you the old war tales of somewhere that they worked and, you know, the fun times that they had. And so the things are told in a comedic way. And I'm sure, you know, for every fun tale, there were probably, you know, many times of drudgery. And actually, some of the challenges are in here, too. And some of the hard times that they had to go through to get these computers out and in the market. I think it's kind of fascinating because you wonder what goes on behind the scenes of trying to actually bring a computer into the marketplace that they're going to turn around and sell millions of. And also how you do it in kind of the wild environment that they were in the 80s. So I like this book. And yeah, I got a chance to chat with Bill and with Margaret for one of the sessions of the Vintage Computer Festival West. We did a interactive interview and we talked about the process of actually making the book, which it's a lot trickier than what you might think. As I've talked to people who have written books, there's so much that goes on under the hood in terms of producing a book. You just don't even think of what it takes to actually come out with something like this. But so we talked some about that, and then we talked about what's in the book. And that was a great conversation. Anyway, I read it. I really liked it. I'm sure I'll read it again. And that's my gift idea. I think it's $25 for the paperback and $20 if you get it on Kindle. And one thing that I heard about the Kindle version is I believe the photographs on the Kindle version are in color. It would have been, I think, cost prohibitive to have them in color in the actual paperback. But of course, pixels are free. So if you get the Kindle version, and there's a lot of photos in there. One of the things I love about it is all the photos are well attributed. They indicate where they got the photo from, when it was from, that kind of thing. So that kind of ties in a lot of the history, pictures worth a thousand words sort of thing.
Very cool. Yeah, I am looking forward to reading this. I've heard that he's engaging speaker and so forth, but I actually have not really heard much of what he had to say. And it's neat to have this documented. I would like to have this level of documentation from Apple.
But, right.
Yeah, Bill is a great storyteller. And one of the things we talked about was why create the book now. And the point was to just get these stories down for posterity, because we're all getting older, memories fade, and you want to write this stuff down and let other people enjoy kind of what it was like to be at Commodore in these days. Apparently it was a little bit destabilizing to be at Commodore after Jack Tramiel had left, because you had a little bit of loss of leadership at the helm there. Mm-hmm. But I won't give away any more. Book is fine.
Excellent. All right. And with all the money you have left over, because the book was actually pretty cheap, we can now turn to eBay. Carrington has, some things for us, including a story of something that wasn't cheap.
Yeah, first thing is an Apple II manual sold at auction for $780,000+, because it was signed by Steve Jobs. You probably heard in the news recently that a letter signed by Steve Jobs went for almost $500,000. And it was somebody had written to Steve Jobs asking for an autograph, and he wrote back saying, "I don't sign autographs," and he signed the letter, which is hilarious. And so that went for $400,000+. But this is an Apple II manual, an Apple II reference manual, and it's signed, and the inscription says, "Julian, your generation is the first to grow up with computers. Go change the world." And it was signed by Steve Jobs, and it was also signed by Mark Markula, who was at Apple for a shorter time than Steve Jobs. So both former Apple people, and so it went for $787,000, which is a lot of money.
Wow.
For a reference manual. Like, oh my gosh. But there's not a lot of things signed by Steve Jobs you can get. So the Steve Jobs inscription, the fact that it's an Apple II manual, it's a big deal. But holy moly, that's a lot of money. Yeah. So you'd have to save a lot of bucks on that book to think to have justified this. But unfortunately, you missed out on this. So you can't have this one. Mm-hmm. Too bad for you. As the inscription also says here, one of Steve Jobs' business cards sold for $13,000. So I think if you think of it in terms of like how much paper you're getting for your money, this is probably a better deal than the business card. But I don't know if that's how one actually should think of that. But I have an auction that is still available to purchase. And it caught my eye because it's something I had no idea what the heck it was. And it's an MSI data cassette tape writer thingy. In the description of the auction, it says, "Up for sale is this vintage tape recorder thing and a modem thing with power supply." So there is a description for you. So this is the MSI Source 2001 with a Source 2300. And these I had to look up because I'm like, well, what are these things? They kind of look like answering machines,
yeah,
but with a big chunky calculator beside it. Like, what is this? And it turns out what this is a very large thing, like the size of an answering machine, you would strap to your wrist and you would walk around holding the keypad, and you would enter information in a store of stuff you wanted to order. And then it would take that information and use the Source 2300 to send it to a remote location that would print out the labels and place the order for you. So this was a remote data collection device. The kind of thing people walk around in grocery stores now with just a wand and beep, 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 beep. Here's the stuff we got to reorder. This is a mid-1970s version of that. Super, super early one. I don't know what you would use it for or how it would even function. But if you were the kind of person who collected that kind of thing, this might be something of a bunch of interest. I don't know. It looks fairly complete. So we got the Source 2001, and this large thing that we're showing on screen right now, this would actually go on your wrist, and it's big.
Wow.
But yeah. So you would strap it to your wrist, and then what we're showing now with the single button, the send button, is essentially like the modem. So you would connect it to this and then fire it off to your ordering warehouse. And then there's this, if you can see a hand in this photo, like a fairly large keypad, this is what you would use to type in the numbers. Like, there's no scanning. It was just like type in the barcode number and then use the buttons on the massive bat computer you strap to your arm to say, order that, or I have too much of that, or whatever. So when I learned about this, and so you see inside, the way this would work is it's an actual cassette. Mm-hmm. So there'd be a cassette inside this, and you would be like, hit record, and then type in the number of the thing you want and the code for I want to reorder it, and then you'd press stop. And then you'd go to the next item and say, oh, here's another barcode I want to order. So you'd press record, type in the numbers you want, press stop. And so you're using this an actual cassette, and then you would put that cassette back to the beginning and hit play, and it would send off the tones, I guess, you've recorded over the modem to the remote location that lets you place your order. It's delightful. So it's $150. Buy it now. Which seems remarkable to me. Like, this seems like a fairly unique item. I don't know. Maybe these are like easy to come by and not collectible. For me, it's $90 shipping. But if you were into like old tech that was like computerized but not an actual computer, this seems pretty cool. And I found a couple of articles, one from November 1971 in the Tennessean, talking about a person using this. And down here in the under the photo of somebody, you can see the size of this thing strapped to his wrist. It says Don Hendricks above, owner of Don's CB Store, 5115 Harding Road, orders groceries now by computer, first time in Nashville. So, and he says he is using the MSI Source 2001 portable data terminal. And so there's an example of when people in 1971 were excited, like, that's how old this tech is. And then there's a Computer World article from 5 years later in February 1976. Talking about a drugstore. Which drugstore was this? Holiday Drugs, using the MSI Source 2001 portable data terminal to do the same thing. You walk around, and it's interesting. I thought really interesting. The last part of the article says the employees are now more efficient. It says there have been changes in work assignments. EOS didn't replace any employees, but they are free to do other things like concentrated computer relations. So it's funny how here we are in 1976, and you can imagine like the economy at the time, people being worried, hold on, are you about to chuck a bunch of people out because you're going to bring in this fancy thing and Holiday Drugs, no doubt, wanted to get in front of that and say, no, they just have more free time. We'd never computerize. Trust me, by 1984, Holiday Drugs had fired everybody. No, but it's interesting. So this is like early 1970s computer tech, and it caught my eye for $150. That's it. Very it's neat. It's large.
Yeah.
I love the wood grain.
Yeah.
Right. It's delightful 1971 technology for $150. Says it powers up. And the problem is, like, this kind of thing, even if you used it and recorded stuff to cassette, there wouldn't be somebody at the receiving end using whatever the equipment was needed for the Source 2300 to talk to. Mm-hmm. So I think it's not actually usable anymore, but it's a very interesting example, looking in good shape, of 1971 technology for data acquisition in stores.
I mean, I suppose you probably could reverse engineer this, just figure out what tones. You could probably just do it all with the keypad.
Right.
You know, figure out what the tones
that's
are.
That's true.
Connect that up to your
like a
Raspberry
lot of work.
Pi.
Yeah. So it's a bit scratched up and stuff, and no doubt this was a thing in use. But it really caught my eye. It's just like such an interesting thing. Like here's 1970s computers. Like, this is years before desktop computers. Like, I was technically alive when this thing was used, but like, you know, barely. Mm-hmm. I just love it. I just love the idea that somebody strapped this big thing to the wrist and was like, hey, I'm running my drugstore and I'm super, super. You'd have to be like very desiring of the cutting edge to buy into something like this. So,
yeah, but there were such people, you know, people who...
Sure, totally. I completely would have been something like that. I would have been like, yeah, I got to have this thing.
Very cool.
Yep.
Okay, we can move on to Earl's.
So mine is a PDP-11 compatible chip. So this is a Russian clone of the PDP-11 F11 chip. The F11 chip is a PDP-11 architecture microprocessor. At DEC, I think they nicknamed the F11 chip the Fonz, which ought to give you some impression about what sort of time frame we're talking about.
Hey.
And for some reason, the PDP-11 architecture seems like it was really popular in Russia. They had those computers, the Electronica models, that I think we've talked about before on the podcast. I think we even talked about one or two eBay auctions with them. And in fact, I think if you go down and look at the description in the auction for this chip, it mentions that the person tested this on their electronica computer.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
right there toward the bottom. Tested on own electronica computer. 100% huh. Works.
Nice.
So trying to paint a word picture for this chip. It's a 40-pin DIP chip, but it's kind of giant in terms of its footprint. And on top of it, it actually has multiple chips that make up this package on a small circuit board, which then that circuit board itself is what has the leads to plug into the dual inline package of whatever you were plugging this in, either an electronica or something else. And in that way, it is actually similar to the corresponding DEC chip, the F11 chip, that also has multiple chip components on top of the package. And a version of the F11 chip is what I have in my own PDP-11, running the 11/23+ board. If you pull out the board, you'll see a processor that looks almost identical to this. And I just love the way this looks. Maybe it's the combination of its aging and the style, but this looks so computery to me, with the little silver chip dies on top and then the kind of drab colored circuit board substrate and the giant feet that, yeah, it almost looks like an enormous insect that's going to come get you. So I thought this was fascinating. I think it's fascinating, the whole thing about the PDP-11 actually being not just a computer for business, but a home computer, the basis of a home computer in Russia back in these days. So that's my pick.
That's crazy to me. PDP-11 mm-hmm. as a home computer. It's like,
I wish we'd had a home computer that was based on the PDP-11.
That was the size of a closet.
Well, actually, that one electronica, the electronica, what is it, the 85? I can't remember. Mm-hmm. It's not that giant of a computer.
It's like Spectrum sized or something.
Mm-hmm. Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not enormous.
Because I think when I think PDP-11, I think cabinet with reels and like, I think
right.
giant thing.
A giant thing of iron.
Right.
And no, they had a
home computer.
That's
part of the appeal, which I would have assumed was part of the appeal in Russia. Like, yes, iron curtain, big iron, it all works.
Exactly. It's got the whole iron thing. Hey, right? I didn't even think of that.
We got a whole iron thing happening here. I would assume that's the appeal. No wimpy, you know, American computer. No, giant. Computer should be size of bear.
Yeah, so here is a... one of them, electronica, I don't know what it is, BK-01001. But, I mean, you know, it's as big as the keyboard. So
crazy. Yep.
Yeah.
Okay, I had no idea that this was a thing. That box shows an absolutely delightful thing beside it, the tape recorder, whatever.
I think this auction is coming from the Russian Federation.
Okay, let me move to something that actually Ian suggested talking about, which is, so this is a feedback of a sort. This is a PDP-12. Do you know the PDP-12?
I know nothing about that particular, except
is it like a Spinal Tap thing? Like this goes to 12.
Yeah.
Right.
So, it looks...
What the heck is a PDP-12?
So apparently, let's say if the... yeah, there's a little history. You know, my dad purchased this in 2014 and so forth. But so apparently this... it is claimed that there are a very small number of these that were ever made. You know, so 700-something. 725 ever made. I don't believe that I'd heard that number before. PDP-12, you know, it seems like an obvious successor to the 11, but it looks very pretty.
Well, you know, what's funny is that sometimes the numbering scheme wouldn't exactly give you the right impression. Mm-hmm. Like the PDP-10 was more like a mainframe, mm-hmm. whereas the PDP-11, a mini computer. And yeah, the difference, kind of similar to the PDP-7, which was a bigger style computer, and then the PDP-8, which was a small... I guess, you know, probably the first small-sized commercially made that they made like 50,000 of them or something like that. So it's hard to tell by the number. It doesn't go successively like that. And I don't know anything about the 12.
Yeah.
Okay, I have a question, though. And it just occurred to me. Are these things color-coded? Like, is the PDB-12 the green one?
I think that they did have color schemes. I seem to remember the 7 having kind of a lime flavor.
Because I just realized, like, when I think of, like, the PDP-11, I think of that reddy kind of stuff. And I just realized PDP-8 had that teal color. And I'm just, hold on. And I guess in my mind, I always thought they must be available in a bunch of colors. But was it the case that it's like, this is the color for this line? Like, you could tell, oh, that's the green one. It's the PDP-12.
I guess I was assumed that you didn't have a color choice. That was Deck made that choice when they made the model.
Right. But, for some reason in my mind, I assumed that these were available in a bunch of colors.
Collect them all.
Right.
No, I'm seeing a 7 right now, okay. And it's kind of that bluish color.
Okay.
And then the 8 had that mustard kind of color.
Okay, so I'm just learning that now. For some reason in my mind, these came in a bunch of colors, and I never really realized till this moment that, wait, hold on, each one was one particular color. So the green one is the PDP-12, which I literally never heard of before today.
Somebody at DEC is really good at choosing colors, though. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are...
I just want to decorate my whole place in big iron colors.
Decorate, I get it.
Oh, I didn't even mean it.
I know there was one that was sort of, it was kind of like a dark pink and something else that really looked very nice. But
Well, I think of the PDP-11 as having that pink kind of color to it.
Yeah, so. Maybe.
But anyway, cool.
But so somebody bought this now. This is no longer available. You can't buy it for $15,000.
Oh, I was so close.
Yeah. and actually... there's a second auction, basically identical. Same photos.
From the same person? Does somebody just like have a bunch of these?
Well, it's actually from a different account. It was also for $15,000. It was also bought now. And the story, so there's even like a drama behind this this story, which is, basically, I had this listed under an alt account. Someone used the buy it now option, and I thought they weren't going to pay. So I relisted it, but I'd reached the limit on my other account. So I reached list, so now it's on this account, but it's the same one. Set this one at a buy it now, $15,000. Same person bought it. So I guess maybe we'll hope that person who bought it for $15,000 twice is actually going to pay on this second one. So anyway.
So I guess there's only 723 left.
Well, no, I think it is. It is in fact the very same one, and the very same buyer.
Oh,
so
I see.
So I guess what happened was,
gotcha.
The guy listed it. I don't understand exactly what the plan was, but it was listed with a $15,000 buy it now. Somebody bought it. He said, "Wait, you're not immediately paying. I'm going to scrap this and try again." Listed it for $15,000. The guy said, "Wait, but I do want it." Bought it again. after the first one was canceled or something. I don't know. Anyway, I'm not sure that things that cost $15,000 are really the right, I'm not sure eBay is the right venue for that.
I've wondered that myself. I mean, you're starting to get up into nosebleed territory. Like
go use Christie's or something. Yeah.
Anyway, I thought it was sort of interesting. And also, continuing the pattern of proper segues between between things.
Do you have a PDP-13 to talk about next?
Maybe I should have found how to power something with a lime.
Okay, you've got your screen shared, Paul, and I can see you've got a big long list of tabs.
Yeah.
How are you jumping directly to the one tab that is the correct one when they all have just like the little eBay thing? Like, did you memorize third from the left is my next one? Like, I'm actually quite impressed by your tabbing.
Well, in fact, actually, on my screen, when I hover over a tab, it shows me the title. So.
Oh, I see. So. I was like, how are you just leaping right to these tabs? Yeah. I do not have that skill.
Yeah. Okay. I also do not, as it turns out.
Okay.
You've killed the mystique now, Paul. We were. You could have gone with that.
It is my superpower. It is a lame superpower, but
what
sometimes
a very
useful.
Lame superpower.
Okay, so let's see. The next thing I was going to talk about, I thought this was sort of interesting. This is voice chess. It is a sophisticated chess game that talks. It's for the Timex Sinclair 2000.
I have questions.
Here we go. Okay, the most advanced chess game available for the 48K Atomic Sinclair 2000. It's actually kind of a nice package. SoftSync is a fairly prominent software publisher for the Atomic Sinclair 1000 series generally. And I thought this was kind of weird because at first I wasn't sure what the Atomic Sinclair 2000 was. It's not a number that I'm familiar with.
That was my first question. Yeah. I'm like, what the heck is that?
It turns out that that's what they were going to call the machine that became the 2068.
Okay.
And that is a number I do know.
Yes, I can say that I know.
Yeah. So anyway, it's a nice package. If you're looking for nice packages, I wonder if it actually has the software in it. It doesn't seem to have a picture of the software now that I look at it. So I thought, I'll just try this out. And I have a Timex Sinclair 2068. And I thought, oh, this will be fun. I'll see if I can boot it up and listen to it. And I spent 20 minutes trying to get this to run on it and gave up. I did get it to run on an emulator. I wonder if I can share that screen. I wonder if that's worth doing. I bet it's not.
So does it talk to you kind of like a Sam sort of voice?
Yeah.
Through the...
Yeah, it does. It doesn't sound too bad. I mean, originally I was thinking, you know, a Timex Sinclair 1000 can barely put a character on a screen. You know, like, how is it going to be talking to you?
Mm-hmm.
But the 2068 is basically like a Spectrum. And so that can kind of handle it. And it's pretty hard to understand what it's saying. But it reads, you know, it reads like it says pawn, you know, D2 to D4 or something like that. Right. And it also recommends moves for you and makes facetious comments.
I was going to ask about that, but I was only joking. I was going to say, does it tell you things like, bet you wish you had your queen back?
I didn't play it long enough to hear any of those comments, but I thought it was pretty pleasing that it actually does show you some of these.
Fantastic. So.
Nice opening, loser.
You make your first move and it says mate in 30. Like, come on.
Right. Anyway, I thought just on that theme, I thought I would. Maybe I should actually say what this was. This was a $30 buy it now. So it's, you know, it's fairly reasonable. $4 shipping to me. And, you know, it's nice if you were into this sort of thing. It's nice if you like that kind of thing. And just, you know, because I was thinking about it, I went to see whether there were any actual 2068s out there. And I found only one, actually, that was for sale. This is, it's currently going for a $125 starting bid.
But it's got a nice box, too.
Yeah, but it is kind of complete looking. You know, it's got the box, it's got the power supply and a cable. I don't think I have the box, actually, so it's nicer than the one I have.
What did they do for storage on this model? So it looks like it has a cassette interface, I guess.
It has an ear and a mic plug, so I suppose it can send mm-hmm. stuff out to cassette. I have a Div MMC Future plugged into mine, which is basically something. It's for the it's for the Spectrum. Here, actually, let me move to this one. This is the thing I have plugged into mine. So this is a little device you put in the back, in the little sort of card adapter in the back. It's called the 2068 Twister ROM HDMI. And so what it does basically is converts the card edge on the back of a 2068 to be compatible with a Spectrum. So then you can plug in anything that you could normally plug into a Spectrum into that. And among the things that you can plug into that is the Div MMC Future, which is a little SD card device that you can put, you know, every Spectrum game ever written or whatever right. on an SD card and,
cool.
and load it up. But the 2068 is not directly compatible with those devices. So you need this, it's called a Twister, I assume, because it sort of rearranges the pins. And this also has this kind of cool, I think we talked about this a couple times ago, video out, which, yeah, it has a 9-pin mini DIN connector that when used with a Sega Genesis video to HDMI adapter will give you HDMI out. So it basically will turn your 2068 into a Sega Genesis as far as the video is concerned, so that then you can use Sega Genesis adapters to get HDMI. And this is the other thing that's sort of relevant about this is that it is the it has the Spectrum ROM on it. I forgot to mention that. But so the 2068 is not a Spectrum and does not have a Spectrum ROM. But if you want to run Spectrum software, you can if you have the ROM. So this device sort of does all those things at once. It adapts the output or the interface and then gives you HDMI compatible out and gives you the Spectrum ROM. And actually, there's a little switch on it so that you can switch between 2068 and Spectrum mode.
Cool.
So
nice.
It's very nice. It is $55. It's, you know, modern.
It's
built.
Kind of a good way to get a Spectrum if you live in North America or whatever,
yeah.
And you want a Spectrum, then you get one of these and this adapter. It's like roundabout, but it's tough to have a Spectrum in North America, in NTSC land.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. Cool. Yeah. I do have a Spectrum, but I've never actually gotten it to do anything, you know, because I have to make sure that I can power it up and get it into some video,
right.
That recognized video. But anyway, so the various things I've talked about are the voice chess, tape, it says. So, I'm surprised that it does not actually...
Presumably there's a cassette.
Yeah.
It's funny that it doesn't show the actual cassette, though.
And then the adapter for the 2068 that can allow you to use... peripherals, including the DivMMC, which I didn't give a link to, but that I think the DivMMC feature also comes from the Future Was 8-Bit site as well. So, and the 2068, which is $125 currently and lasts for another 6 days. So if I edit this fast.
So a couple $100, you can have a Sinclair.
Yeah.
Here.
Yeah, right.
Cool.
Sort of natively. Well, and actually, the other thing too is that the 2068 can run 2068 stuff. Which the Spectrum cannot, so also good.
That actually appeals to me a lot because, I like the Spectrum. I have a soft spot for it, and it's a computer I never had any experience with at all. So it's weird. So I don't have a nostalgia for it, but there's just something about the Spectrum and its weird colors and just like the whole thing starting from the early things. And just the Speccy was a computer I think I would have liked and used if I had been a UK person. Like, I think I would have really been into it. So I see that alternative version of me.
Yeah.
So I can imagine like quite liking having a 2068. Specifically to give myself a Spectrum.
Yeah.
So cool. There's a lot of Spectrum games I would like to play.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm looking forward to doing that. I basically I only just got that, the Twister thing, and the Spectrum ROM quite recently. So I really have not had much chance to play with it except for just this, you know, like failed 15 minutes recently. So, anyway, I'm not sure to what extent you have experience with these keyboards. They're crazy. They are insane keyboards. So the picture in the auction actually is kind of fuzzy. It's a little bit it's hard to see. Now maybe this is a better one. But the keyboard, every key has many functions. So I don't even know. There's like five different things you can do basically. Like you can switch into alternate mode, and then there's a shift and a non-shift. And so every key you can type, you know, a command or another command, or a character or a punctuation mark. It's just
because touch typing is for chumps.
It is really
look
hard.
It up every time.
But the other thing is that you don't have to type in basic commands. I mean, like the basic commands are actually all there. So you hit L or whatever for load. So I guess
but the time savings of not having to type the extra characters. Must be more than taken up with the whole hunt for where it is.
Yeah.
You can't just type load. You got to look for it. There it is.
Yeah.
If I hold down shift, option, non-shift, up, left, smiley face,
yeah.
Q.
Well, and that's the thing too. Like there's different modes that you can be in, and to switch modes, you have to hit like shift option together. You know, to switch to different modes, so then you can get at the different, the alternative commands are, and it's quite an adventure. I think you probably can get used to it, and it probably is actually like the Spectrum. But
In the chat, Matt says that you can get pretty quick. You can actually get used to it.
Yeah.
I think Matt is overestimating my skills, but I appreciate it, Matt.
Yeah.
Mods are good. I would never get good.
Yeah.
But other people probably would rock it.
It looks kind of similar to, I don't know how the keys actually feel when you press them, but
it's got a real Coco One feel to it, I bet. I look at that thing and it looks like a so square.
they're
calculator keyboard.
They're no, actually they're pretty hard. They're not squishy.
Okay. I mean, it looks a little similar to the keyboard that's on the TI CC40.
Yeah.
That small little kind of almost, I'm a computer, but I'm almost a calculator kind of form factor.
Yeah, my original Coco had like that kind of keyboard, like these hard buttons that stuck up. It's very, very unpleasant to type on.
Yeah.
It's an angry keyboard. Oh, look at that. And Paul is waving the actual one in front of us.
Yeah.
There it is.
But
press on it so we can hear it.
Oops. The noise you heard before me typing was me clonking the thing into my headphones.
But also important for us to know how that sounds.
Anyway.
That is pretty neat.
Yeah. But I
like everything about this.
I think generally when I was saying it took me 15 minutes to fail, many of those minutes were trying to look up, like, how do I get into that other mode to get to type? Because poke, you know, in order to get into Spectrum mode, you have to poke something. And to do poke, you have to go Alt into another mode and then Shift to do poke and then go back to, you know, number mode. And anyway, so. Okay. Next thing I have is... I thought this was interesting. I don't know. There's a sense in which it's kind of timeless. It is a vintage iOmega monitor rear view mirror. And it is, it's basically just a mirror that you put on your monitor so you can see when people are looking over your shoulder.
Oh my God. I completely remember the iOmega brand. My goodness.
I don't know why.
And I worked in an office where some people had these. Up on their monitor, so that they, you know, you could never sneak up on them.
Sure, I could. You just got to ninja crawl. They'll never see you coming.
That's right.
If they've got that up, you can really surprise them.
Yeah, right. Exactly, because it's a false sense of security.
Also, you could take a picture of what it shows and stick it over that, so they think it's a mirror, but it's just a photograph. There's lots of ways to fool them.
That's right. Or you could work out some kind of little loop, like in all the thriller movies.
I've looped the feed.
That's right. Anyway, it's $7 starting bid.
For $7, this is pretty cool, I got to admit. So it's kind of got a purple feel to it. Was this something that was supposed to be in the, like, on purple computers? It's got a bit of an iMac feel to it? Is the purpleness to it?
My thought is that it probably goes with the iOmega devices. And I you know, so it's more, it looks more purple than any Zip Drive did. But I don't know some of the other ones.
When I think iOmega, I think Zip Drive, definitely. Like, that's their thing.
I wonder if was the Jazz Drive maybe more purple? No, that was green. I don't know.
But the Zip Drive was purple. It was definitely purple. Maybe the colors on the auction just aren't as good. I don't know.
Yeah.
But that's crazy.
Well, I think the Zip Drive was blue. iOmega Zip Drive. You're right. I guess the USB ones... were purple. So the scuzzy ones were blue, though, for sure, because I have many. Here's a very washed out blue one. That's so this blue that I'm showing on the screen is the blue that I think of as a Zip Drive, but the purple, there is a purple USB one. Yeah,
so crazily I just went searching to see if I could figure out what's up with this, and then just googling iOmega monitor mirror thingy. It's up till recently been available on Amazon. It has reviews from 2019,
nice.
Of people kind of complaining about it. One person saying they broke their no iOmega rule to buy this thing based on the... And that was in 2019. I'm like, what? What is wrong with you, man?
Yeah.
Like, crazily. And people saying that it doesn't make things appear closer than they should. Like, people kind of complaining about the mirrorness of it when they bought this thing in 2017. And they had to use duct tape to attach it to their monitor because the clip breaks.
Yeah.
What is going on?
Oh, well. Okay, and then I guess the only last thing that I found, it was sold already. Oh, well. Maybe it doesn't matter. I saw this. It was Commodore VIC 20, VIC 4th. And,
ooh.
Yeah.
Earl, did you buy it?
No, is this the HES?
It port? Is, yeah.
Yeah, I have one of these.
Ah, okay. I just thought it would be a good name for a fictional PI.
Yeah. Excellent.
That's all.
It was a dark and stormy night.
Vic Forth is on the job.
Anyway. all right. I think I could leave it there. Well, actually, no. There's one more thing that I might want to talk about, just because I'm curious about it. It is, what is it? Ethernet Asante Talk. Ethernet to local talk bridge.
Oh, okay. I remember these things. Sure.
So I just basically saw this and had a question. Do these basically serve the same function as like a bridge MAC would? If you wanted to try to connect your, you know, SE30 to the internet.
To the internet. I don't know. Like, I remember these things. In fact, I probably implemented one of these at least at one company, I remember, because people would have a local top network sharing a printer or whatever, but then you'd have an Ethernet network larger throughout the facility. So in a couple of places where I set up computing that had desktop publishing, like say a certain floor had a whole bunch of desktop publishing machines, they would have a local talk network, often going to a RIP or going to something. Mostly it was for sharing local printers or local scanner or something, just among a collection of 5 or 10 computers. And there would be an Ethernet network throughout the whole company. And of course, nowadays you would just have an Ethernet network everywhere, but you know, networking was very expensive. And so this would just let the two networks see each other.
See.
So people on the Ethernet network could print to the printer and so forth. So I don't believe it would let you, I don't know if it would have been implementing like IP stuff.
I see.
I don't know if it talked IP.
Okay. Right.
That's what I'm thinking as well. It did talk EtherTalk to allow me to get a Mac, one of the classic Macs, connected up to a server, and there was some EtherTalk software that you could run on Linux way back in the day, Netatalk, I think it was. And so it allowed me to get some software onto the Mac, but I don't know if I ever tried an IP protocol layer on it.
Right.
Which is strange because Asante, you're right, Paul, did make those adapters specifically for one computer that would say, okay, I'm going to let it get on and Ethernet, but those were often going through SCSI. They made a lot of SCSI adapters. You plugged SCSI, and that would let you get on the internet if you wanted.
Right.
It would be now you have an Ethernet port, and you could run SLIP, you could run whatever. So I've experienced with those as well. But my experience with this thing is it just bridged the networks and gave you local talk protocol on the Ethernet side.
I see.
And it wasn't about letting the local talk people get to the internet or whatever.
Okay. This one also, at least up until recently, was apparently available on Amazon. I'm looking, I've got the Amazon listing here, and there are reviews. Works great, even for Apple II equipment.
Which from 2014.
Which I think is pretty cool as a, you know, an Amazon review. Mm-hmm. So, anyway. Okay, yeah, so I think at least I understand better what that is and isn't. This particular Asante Talk Bridge is currently at $39 with 6 bids and 3 days to go as we record. Who knows if that will be still available by the time this gets edited and out, but they come up somewhat often. I have one that I picked up, I think, at like a, you know, it's just sort of like discarded somewhere. And I thought, you know, specifically I might be able to use this maybe if it functioned for this. And so I can still use it to connect file sharing between an Apple II and something.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay. That's all I had. And Blake had some things that he will talk about some other time, no doubt.
Yeah. If power ever gets restored.
Right. Right. Yeah, apparently he lives in an area where all the wires are up in the air and there's nothing can be done about it. And so all the trees frequently blow over onto them. So anyway. So I guess we've reached closing discussions. I missed one.
You missed one? Yeah. Bring it back.
Yeah. I don't know if it's that important, but this I thought it was kind of interesting. 1986 multifunction switching matrix, operator's manual, volume 1, for your eyes only. And it's a thing that says, top secret, do not open until instructed. And, you know, you can have this very, very intriguing looking thing. It's a CIA document number. You know, comes in a little envelope. It's been opened, of course, you know, so that you can see it. Anyway, does anyone know what this is?
I feel like this is just from a game.
Yeah, yeah. it doesn't actually say anything anywhere here, as far as I can tell. 1986 Multifunction Switching Matrix Operator's Manual, Volume 1, For Your Eyes Only. It does seem like it's pretty, you know, it's pretty exciting. Yeah, maybe I want the secret CIA document. The giveaway is that it's and copyright 1986, Activision Inc.
Oh, Activision. Okay.
It is actually from Hacker 2. Whatever. It's one of the documents that comes with the Hacker 2 program. Which, did you guys ever play that?
I never played either the original Hacker or Hacker 2. Mm-hmm. So they're on my eventual list. That, you know, that future time when I'm going to have all this time on my hands, I'll eventually play 3,000 games.
Right. Yeah.
Supposedly.
I'm hoping that in my old age, my fingers still work because it's going to be kind of critical.
I've made a lot of investments on Steam and GOG and stuff for all these games that apparently I think I'm going to want to have time for.
Right. But okay, I guess we can go to closing discussions. And Carrington, do you have any closing thoughts?
I have nothing. I've done very little retro stuff, except I do continue to plug away a little bit on the Puny Inform game I've been working on, and it's very fun. I really do, other than the sexism in the language I talked about last time, I'm quite enjoying it as a development thing. It is very fun to make text adventures in that environment. I'm digging it a lot, and I kind of see the end game coming. So I think another week or two, I'll probably have it all wrapped up and be ready to play. So I'm digging it.
Cool.
Cool.
Mr. Allen in the chat asks if Earl was there for the Fortran-based board game, and Earl was not there.
Did you see the
Fortran-based board game that came up on the previous episode? I don't know if it was the last time or the time before, but what was it again?
I saw that one had, but I didn't look into it. Actually,
now I want to remember what was the tagline for it? It was something ridiculous, like
It was. Here, okay, I found it on Board Game Geek. Input reason, output pleasure.
Yeah, yeah, that's pretty excellent. yeah, that's right. It was actually the previous episode, long, long ago. But
yeah, so for people who missed it, I'm sharing an image. So yeah, take a look. Fortran board game. There you go. Input reason, output pleasure. It's a game for you, Earl. Yeah. It's a game in which you do Fortran programming as a board game. Yeah. Your kids will love it.
Yeah. You know, once a week we do like family night, and sometimes it's family game night. I'm sure everyone would appreciate if I got this and brought it to the
table.
And
by everyone, you mean
you. Mean
yeah.
Me.
Yeah, I think Blake said something sort of similar, and I was thinking that what this would do, if you do suggest this, this will make all your other suggestions seem like one step better.
Exactly.
So,
not the Fortran game again.
You behave, or else.
Yes, exactly.
Or we're playing Fortran.
Or it's do loops for you.
I've now been, because of that, I keep finding weird computer and computer language based board games on eBay. I almost made all my eBay picks this time. Maybe I'll do it next time. There's C games. There's a whole bunch. Mm-hmm. Like it's crazy how many computer based or programming based board games there are.
Right.
I want a fourth game.
Okay, yeah. I'll get right on it.
You do everything backwards.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, and you know, I imagine that all of these games were like somebody thought it would be fun to write this game. Nobody thought it would be fun to play this game.
Well, somebody apparently thought it would be fun to sell this game.
That's right. Mm. Yeah. I think, yeah, I'm just remembering all the jokes from last time about how the rare ones are the opened ones and all that. But, yeah, very nice. Earl, any closing thoughts?
I've just been doing one thing that I've been working on and off that actually was kind of fun. I made the Altair talk to an Arduino. So
neat.
In the Altair, there is this board you can get called the 88-4 PIO. It's a parallel IO board. And it actually, if you completely outfit it with all the chips, has 64 bits of simultaneous input-output that you can talk to the Altair with. So I'm not sure all the things that these were used for back in the day, but I looked at it and I thought, I think it should talk to an Arduino, because I wanted it to talk to the Arduino and then have the Arduino control one of those NeoPixel, those bright multicolor LED matrices, and have the Altair, actually you could write a basic program on the Altair that would send patterns out through the LEDs. That's my end goal, but I'm not quite there yet, but I did get pretty much 100% reliable bytes spewing from the Altair into the Arduino, which I thought was fun.
Cool. That's pretty pleasing.
Yeah, and I actually, this was like the uber nerdy thing, is that I first did it in BASIC, but it was pretty slow in BASIC. Microsoft BASIC on the Altair does have an I.O. command you can use to send through the 8080 I.O. ports, but it was like really painfully slow. So I wrote the program instead in 8080 assembly language, and it sped it up like, I think, 20-fold. So at that point, it would actually be able to spew out bytes fast enough to maybe even make the LED matrix do some patterns and things like that. So kind of a useless thing to do, but it just, you know, I did it because it was there. And it was pretty cool, too, that I got to hook up the, you know, the old flat ribbon cable. Mm-hmm. I just love that stuff for whatever. What I bought off eBay, you could buy the boring stuff with just all the gray conductors, or you could buy the rainbow cable that had all the fun colors. Yeah, so that's what I bought. And plugged it into these 24-pin dip socket things that you... Anyway, it was interesting just building the cabling to get it to talk, but... That's my project.
You jumped the gun on the retro challenge.
Yeah, I was just thinking that.
Retro challenge. No, I did it a little too soon. Well, maybe the retro challenge will be getting the other Altair with the switches to work, because I thought that I was there because I took it all apart and I cleaned it up, and there was a blown capacitor on the main front panel that was causing one of the circuits to short out. It was one of those tantalum capacitors. Those things are notorious for... Mm. Shorting out. So I actually, with the help of some online material, diagnosed what capacitor it was and replaced it with another one. But before I plugged it all back in, I just hooked up the Altair mainboard itself, which on an S100 system is nothing. It's just a complete passive motherboard. It just has the card slots. So then I turned on power. And there was a big spark and a loud bang, and the power supply stopped working. I thought, how in the world can I shut this out when there's literally nothing plugged into it? How is that? How did I even do that? That takes amazing skill. Mm-hmm. So at that point, I looked at it and I thought, you're going for a timeout, mister. And I stuck it back in the storage room, and I haven't taken it back out since.
Do that again, you're playing the Fortran board game.
Exactly. Yeah. So maybe that'll be my retro challenge, trying to figure out how I shorted out something that had absolutely zero plugged into it.
Excellent.
It's a skill.
Let's see. I'm trying to think of what happened since the last time. My 2E card works. I now have a working 2E card.
Oh, nice. So you got recapped.
Yep. So that's kind of nice. I haven't done anything really much with it, but... and actually, one thing I was thinking about back when we were talking about screensavers is the Color Classic that I have has After Dark installed on it. And one thing I do remember about the screensavers is that, I never want it to come on. Like, when it comes on, it's like, oh, wait, I should have bumped the mouse. And so I bumped the mouse. And so the thing I mainly remember is all these windows slowly coming back to life, you know, like in the old Macintosh drawing way. That's the main thing I remember about screensavers. But I also just got a friend of mine, his parents are moving and sort of packing up their house. And he asked me if I wanted his old Apple II stuff. And I said, well, I have a lot of that stuff, but I know some people who might. So, yeah, send it my way and I'll see what happens to it after that. But one thing that came recently was a box of old like developer documentation. So apparently, I think it was... Must have been his parents that were Apple developers, you know. So it's got a bunch of newsletters and the folders, product specifications, and stuff like that. And it's kind of neat, you know. So I've got the what was it? There's a newsletter for Apple developers called Outside Apple, which seems like it doesn't seem like the best name somehow. It doesn't seem mm-hmm. like, all right, well, you know, come join our group, outside, right. outsiders.
Doesn't feel inclusive at all. Yeah.
But I get their idea. There was the inside apple and you're like the outside apple thing. So yeah. It does seem kind of exclusive.
Like,
yeah.
Pointing out the fact that you, like, we have the advantage.
Let's all develop. You're out there.
But anyway, yeah, so there was this newsletter, and I have something like, I don't know, 10 or so issues of it. I've kind of been scanning them just so that I, you know, have them. I didn't see them out there anywhere.
Yeah, I've never heard of it before, so it'd be definitely make sure if they need to be archived or whatever.
Yeah.
It's cool.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. But so I looked at a couple of them. One of the first ones I picked up, I guess, was April 1987, and it says, whatever.
Well, it's much later than I would have thought.
Yeah, these are 1987, 1988. But still in the Apple II time. So they still have some discussion of, like, you know, development on the Apple II or whatever. And they have, you know, Guy Kawasaki has a little column in there. And there's, like, classifieds. Classifieds are sort of interesting because they talk a little bit about, like, people looking for people to write educational software or people looking for publishers for their software or whatever. It's a little bit interesting. But so I picked up the April 1987 one, and it says a misinformation source for the underdeveloped. And it goes on to talk about how, you know, like, Apple's like branching off now going into moving into a new industry in which they are selling apple juice and apple pie and laser fries. And so it turns out that like 20% of the issues I have are April Fool's issues. Which is kind of interesting in its own right, you know, like they have a little fake.
And I can see why somebody would save those ones, though, because yeah. they're like ongoing funny. Whereas if it's a developer thing from 2 years ago, you're like, if it's just informational, it's all out of date. But if it's comedy, you might save it.
Yeah. And I also was thinking that these are probably more fun to read now by me than they were for someone, you know, for who was like an ongoing concern, you know, where they actually had to try to like deal with whatever was being whatever information was being distributed here. But
And it's funny if this is for an Apple II development thing who at the time, if it's late 80s, are feeling very much kind of excluded by Apple, who's moving on to the Mac and blah, blah, blah. And call it outside Apple. It's really just like, yeah, inside is for Mac users and Lisa, whatever. And you, Apple II people, you're still important to us because you're the only reason we're not bankrupt. But other than that.
Yeah, and it's not – so this isn't I'm not sure that whether these people are Mac developers or Apple II developers. There's still some Apple II content in here, but it's, you know, mostly Mac.
I see. Okay.
So
I thought it was like a 1988 Apple II development newsletter. Yeah. And I was like, wow, that is crazy that Apple would be doing that.
Yeah.
Guess they weren't.
But in fact, actually, the Apple II GS is on the cover of the June 87, you know, one. So
well, sure.
That seems about right.
Right.
Back when they thought that was going somewhere. anyway, but it's interesting. I guess the other thing too, though, as I was going through it, is I kind of wish that the April Fool's ones were funnier. You know, like the jokes just don't land. So anyway, I scanned them anyway. They will soon be readable. But
although I wish I had some laser fries, because that actually sounds pretty good.
The sad thing is going to be that the best stuff is going to be the stuff that doesn't exist and is in the April Fool's thing. anyway, that was kind of fun, though, you know, sort of going through the binders and, you know, sort of testing out my scanning workflow, too. But so that's what I've been doing.
Cool. Very cool. Yeah.
And anything else?
Nope.
So then that is it for this show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. Carrington will do his little dance as we go through this. You can discuss the show on the forums at vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. You can follow RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast. You can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/rcrpodcast. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network, I think. Actually, I haven't checked in on that for a long time, but I've been saying it. So I hope that
we might still be.
I hope we're still there.
I hope we haven't been kicked out yet.
But, that is at throwbackreviews.com. Please rate a review on iTunes if you wish. And until next time,
Retro Compute. So is the goal that for next time we'll just stick with screensavers? Because I assume if other people come on board, they're going to have things to say. Yeah, it's the same things we said.
And, I mean, clearly it doesn't matter if we said the same thing last time, because we went through all the same Fortran board game jokes
right.
two episodes in a row.
It's evergreen.